I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is political consultant and former senior advisor and chief campaign strategist to President Obama, David Axelrod. He's joined in conversation by former campaign manager to President Obama, David Plouffe. And now, join Marcy Glazer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces David Axelrod and David Plouffe.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. I'm Marcy Glazer, CEO, and I'm delighted to host all of you for a terrific evening with David Axelrod and David Plouffe. Whether as a young journalist investigating city corruption, a campaign consultant guiding underdog candidates, or a senior advisor to the President of the United States during one of the worst crises in American history, David Axelrod held fast to his faith in the power of stories to unite diverse communities and ignite transformative political change. Describing the appeal of politics, he told the Los Angeles Times, "I got into politics because I believe in idealism. Just to be part of this effort that seems to be rekindling the kind of idealism that I knew when I was a kid, an idealism that we believe strongly in here at the JCCSF." A legendary strategist and the mastermind behind Barack Obama's historic election campaigns, David Axelrod is here this evening to share some stories. Who better to get the conversation off the ground tonight than David Plouffe, campaign manager for Obama's 2008 campaign and senior advisor to the president after David Axelrod from 2011 until 2013. And we welcome him here to the Bay Area as of September 2014, he is the Senior Vice President of Policy and Strategy at Uber Technologies. Please join me in welcoming David Axelrod and David Plouffe to the JCCSF.
Well, good to be with all of you. David, we could probably be here for 5 hours.
So cancel your evening.
Right. Whatever you had afterwards. This is such a brilliant and elegant book, no matter the subject. David is such a gifted writer. But let's start in the beginning. You write in the book about growing up in New York City and the moment that really sparked your interest in politics with a chance encounter with Bobby Kennedy. Talk a little bit about that.
Jack Kennedy, actually. Right. But I would be remiss if I didn't say what a treat it is to be with my pal David Plouffe. We've been linked together in some extraordinary projects, and it's fair to say that there probably wouldn't be a book, and there wouldn't be a President Obama without David's brilliance. So, we don't get to see each other that much anymore, so this is like a one-night thing. It's like Simon and Garfunkel, you know. It's like,
we will stay here all night. Long after you're gone, we'll just keep the conversation.
But, interest in politics began when I was freakishly young. I was 5 years old, and I know the exact day. It was October 27th, 1960. John F. Kennedy came to Stuyvesant Town, where I grew up in New York City. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's New York transplants. It was a housing development built for returning war veterans. And JFK was barnstorming New York. And David will immediately light on the fact that how interesting it was that a Democrat felt the need to campaign in New York City 10 days before the election. New York was that's how old I am. New York was a swing state then. There was a woman who took care of me when I was small, when my mother was at work, her name was Jessie Berry. She was an African-American woman, a classic story. She came up from the South no real formal education, but lots of wisdom, and she kind of raised me. And she thought, she heard JFK was coming, thought it would be good for me to see, and she took me out to 20th Street where he was going to speak and put me on a mailbox so I can see. And I watched 20th Street, which normally was filled with cars, filled with people. And this, you know, charismatic, red-haired guy jumped up on a stage and started speaking. And his voice was booming off the buildings, and everybody was paying rapt attention to him. And I didn't obviously understand everything he was saying, or lots of what he was saying, but I did. I had a sense that it was really important, and that this was really exciting. And I was kind of hooked. And then 4 years later, I ended up, you know, I was giving out leaflets for his brother Robert when he was mm-hmm. running for the Senate. I mean, I was a little junior politician, not a strategist yet. And when I was 10 years old, I made a momentous decision, and I broke with the Democratic Party and worked for a Republican candidate for mayor of New York, John Lindsay, liberal Republican. And if you want to know what that looks like, they've got them stuffed and on display over at the museum. And so, you know, I was really... But I was attracted to these people who believed that politics was about big things, not little things. You know, Robert Kennedy said, the future's not a gift, it's an achievement. And that is a profound, simple and a profound statement. That's the politics that I believe in. I know it's the politics you believe in. It's the thing that attracted us to Barack Obama. And it all sort of started with that one encounter with JFK. I'll let you get a question in here, by the way. I realize Pluff's sitting here thinking, I'm here
this
for
is like this. How our conference calls you.
Yes, he's got a lot of experience with this. He was very good about letting me talk, and he talked myself out before he imparted some wisdom. But when I was 19, I was a student at the University of Chicago. And, you know, I went to Chicago because... For three reasons. One was that it was a great university. I knew that. The second was that it was 600 miles from New York, so I knew my parents wouldn't surprise me with a visit. But the third reason was it was a great political town. You know, they just had the Democratic Convention in 1968, which was of historic calamity. The last of the big city machines was still alive, Richard J. Daley. And there were the beginnings of this black independent political movement, particularly on the south side of Chicago where the university was. And I thought, what an interesting place to be. And then I got to the university, and I found that nobody wanted to talk about anything that happened after the year 1800. And that's really why I started writing for newspapers, because that was a way to sate my interest in politics.
So your mother wrote for PM, and then you, at a young age, 22, became the chief political writer of the Chicago Tribune.
I was more like 24.
Okay, I'm giving you 2 years there. Okay. But really historically young age. Talk about some of the great characters you covered during that time.
Well, you know, the Chicago politics was an incredibly rich... it was a target-rich environment, you know, for a reporter. But, you know, and even before I got to the Tribune, when I was a young, like, community newspaper reporter, I made it my business to learn about, you know, there were 50 wards in Chicago, and there were, like, ethnic, you know, baronies. And, you know, the ward committeemen lorded over the wards and the aldermen. Sometimes they were the same, sometimes they weren't. And I knew the history. I knew all of those characters, you know. Some of them were, but Vito Marzullo and Roman Puchinsky and Ed Verdoliak, and then, you know, all the you know, great characters in the African-American wards. And, you know, it was really, and there was like a Byzantine history to every one of these wards. And so I knew all of that when I went to the Tribune. And then there was Daley himself. You know, I wrote in the book about this guy Verdoliak, who is a recurring character in the early years of my political writing and politics. There was a really kind of a smart aleck guy from the southeast corner of the city, the steel mills, who, you know, came from a Croatian immigrant family and became a lawyer and a real, you know, sharpie in politics there. When Mayor Daley had a stroke in, I think, 1974, and he disappeared for like 6 months. And now the reporters are like wondering what's going to happen, like how's the party going to run? And they said to Vrdoljak, well, slate making's coming up for candidates. How are we going to pick the candidates? And Vrdoljak said, well, just like always, Daley will tell us who we're for, and we'll be for him. and the reporter said, but Ed, you don't even know if he can speak. And Vrdoljak shrugged and said, he can point, can he? And that's the way it was. There were all these characters like that. It was a wonderful beat. I actually spent two and a half years on nights when I got to the Tribune. It was a great place to be, honestly, after my dad passed away. I was looking for some ballast, and the newsroom and the editors became these great kind of front page characters, you know, who loved news and loved the story and everything. They kind of embraced me. But the city editor was a guy named Bertie Judge, and he said, I know you know everything about Chicago politics more than anybody I have, but you don't know how to be a reporter. So he said, I'm putting you on nights. And I stayed there for 2.5 years covering murder and mayhem, and which, as it turns out, was good preparation for covering Chicago politics.
So from Ed Vrdoljak to Paul Simon, quite a journey.
Yeah.
So you made the transition in 1984,
right,
from the reporter world to the political world, and accepted Paul Simon's offer to manage his campaign.
Right.
So why did you make that jump, and why Paul Simon?
Well, I loved being a newspaper man. I loved it. It was a great, you know, for me as a young kid, it was an incredible education. I loved to write. I loved the characters, you know. But around 6 years in, I saw the leading indicator of changes in the newspaper industry. They brought in new management, and they're much more bottom line oriented. They wanted to increase their margins. And the wall between the business side and the city room, which was sacrosanct when I got there, sort of collapsed. They brought in a new editorial team that, instead of editors who really supported you and, you know, were as excited about your stories as you were, they brought in guys who basically their attitude was 1,000 people want your job, so I don't need to give you a pat on the back, you know. And it just became a less fun place to work. Plus, there were manifestations of changes there. I covered national politics as well, and I covered the 1984 presidential race. And I went to Iowa, and I started writing stories about this guy Gary Hart. And I said I thought he could maybe break through, and he did. And he won the New Hampshire primary. And now there was this interesting story. He was challenging Walter Mondale, prohibitive favorite, former vice president, for the dubious honor of running against Ronald Reagan. But my question was, how does a guy who managed George McGovern's campaign 12 years earlier and who had a 95% rating from the Americans for Democratic Action, which was sort of the litmus test of liberalism, how does he go down south now and run in these southern states? And he had a very well-conceived strategy, you know, that had to do... He had worked on military reform issues, became close to Sam Nunn in Georgia, who then endorsed him the day after the New Hampshire primary and so on. And so I wrote a story about this and stayed up all night working on this piece, turned it in, really proud of it. And then when I got back to the newspaper, because it wasn't the internet era, so I couldn't see what they ran, I found that they had taken my quotes from my story and the quotes from the guy who was covering Walter Mondale and basically turned it into a wire service story. And I was furious, and I went to the national editor and I said, well, why are we even out there? You know, the wire services report what people say every day. And he said, well, we just didn't have the news hole. And I could kind of see the future. And Paul Simon came along, and he had been on me for some time to go to work for him. And, you know, Paul was a great guy. Some of you may remember Paul. Yeah, he deserves a hand. He was a great guy. He was like the Orville Redenbacher of Illinois politics. You know, he had horn-rimmed glasses and a bow tie. Paul, this is classic Paul. He uh, he always had, his suits were always too short. And it turned out that one of his constituents died and bequeathed him 6 suits. And he just never had them altered, you know. But it says something that he had a constituent who bequeathed him his suits. But Paul was also a guy I felt a kinship with because he had quit college and bought a newspaper when he was 19 years old in deep southern Illinois, crusaded against a crime syndicate down there that everybody was intimidated by and tried to get people to run against their candidates for public office. And when he couldn't find anybody who was courageous enough to do it, he did it and got elected to the legislature. And in the legislature, he was a tremendous advocate as a young man. I think he was 21 or something when he got elected, very young. He was a crusader for civil rights, and his district was closer to Little Rock than it was to Chicago. And it was really, you know, an amazingly courageous thing to do. He also was a big advocate for political reform, which is almost as courageous in the Illinois legislature as having been for civil rights from southern Illinois. And he was just a guy of utter probity and decency. And I thought, if I'm going to make this jump, let me go for a guy who I believed in and who I knew would never embarrass me. And you know, I went over there actually as the communications director, and there was turmoil in the campaign. And I ended up as the campaign manager, you know, like a couple of months after I left the newspaper business. We were running against Charles Percy, who was a 3-term incumbent, a Republican, and who had been, you know, he ran for years. He was a moderate Republican, and then all these moderate Republicans started losing: Clifford Case, Jacob Javits, all of his peers, and the Reagan Revolution came, and Percy tried to get right with the right, and started shifting his positions, including on school prayer and some things that, you know, they're conspicuous when you change your mind. And Paul was stalwart, you know, in his views. And so even in the year of the Reagan landslide, we were able to win by running as a guy who believed in things. And that was, our slogan was, a senator you could count on. Paul ended up getting a quarter of the self-described conservatives in that race, and won even as Reagan was carrying the state by a landslide. And that was it. I was often running in the political consulting business.
So from there, you started a consulting firm and elected mayors and governors and senators. But let's skip forward, though, 18 years.
Okay.
Just in
I guess my answers are running a little long.
No. yeah, I do reflect back on all the times you would lecture the president on keeping his answers to 60 seconds.
I know. It's a classic case of do as I say, not as I do.
So one of David's great gifts, I think, is during his political consulting time, and really starting back to Paul Simon, is he would often take on people who others thought couldn't win, who he simply believed in. So let's go to 2002, and there's a state senator named Barack Hussein Obama who decides to meet with you and talks about his run
for
the U.S.
Senate. Yeah.
So tell the audience about your decision to work for him and what you saw that really no one else saw.
Right. Well, let me say someone else saw something in 1992, because I had a friend in Chicago named Betty Lou Saltzman, who was kind of a doyen of liberal politics there, and you know Betty Lou. And she called me and she said, I just met this remarkable young man and I think you ought to meet him. And I said, I'm happy to meet anybody you want me to meet, Betty Lou, but why are you so eager for me to meet this guy? She said, I think he could be the first black president of the United States. And so now I always say I take Betty Lou with the track with me whenever I go. I met with him, and we had lunch. That he had just come from Harvard Law School, just graduated. And well, as I said in the book, I didn't walk away humming "Hail to the Chief." I did. I saw in him the qualities that I find attractive in politicians, because, as you know, the world of politics divides into two categories. There's that first category that's more numerous, of people who want to be something. And then there's the smaller, more admirable quality of people who want to do something. And he clearly was in that second category. Here's a guy who could have written his ticket anywhere, leaving Harvard, any law firm, any corporation, and set himself for life. And instead he came back to Chicago to work on a voter registration drive and work in a small civil rights firm. And he clearly had political ambitions, but his ambitions, I mean, he was approaching it more as a calling than a business, and I admired him for that.
You're listening to political consultant and campaign strategist David Axelrod, whose new memoir is Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. He's joined in conversation by David Plouffe on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
But I didn't work with him for 10 years. He ran for the state senate in 1996. He made an impression in the state senate. One of his first bills was the first kind of campaign finance reform bill in maybe forever in the Illinois legislature. But it ended this quaint practice that they had in Illinois where you could raise campaign money and then keep it for yourself. This is absolutely the God's honest truth. All you had to do was pay taxes, and you could keep it. And that's only because the IRS insisted. So he shamed them into changing that. But he also helped he was the guy who was designated by the Democrats to negotiate the welfare reform law after it was passed in Washington. Illinois' version was much more progressive than some of the other states. And he did a lot. And then he ran for Congress, as you know, in 2000. And that was an ill-fated decision. He narrowly lost by 30 points. And so in 2002, he was facing this existential crisis because he had lost this race. He was deeply in debt. And I think he was feeling some pressure to either establish his political career or get out. And he had basically made an up-or-out bargain with Michelle. I was going through an existential crisis myself because although we had great success, I was beginning to become very concerned about sort of the degree of cynicism that I saw in our business. And it manifested itself in one particular story, which is I had a client in the 1990s in Illinois, named Rod Blagojevich. Which, by the way, engenders the same response everywhere I go. And I liked Rod. He ran for Congress. I helped him run for Congress. I thought he was a guy who really identified with working class people. He was smart. I thought he was a good guy. And he was very nice to me personally once he got elected. One of my sons spent three summers there working as an intern, and Rod couldn't have been nicer to him. But he came to me in 2001 and said he wanted to run for governor. I thought, governor, that's like a real job. Why do you want to run for governor? And he said, well, you can help me figure that out. And I said to him, look, man, if you can't tell me, you shouldn't run. My job isn't to tell you why you should be governor or why you want to be governor. I can help explain it if you can explain it to me. And that was the end of our relationship. But he hired a very proficient firm that you know well, and they did a great job for him. And, you know, they did all the blocking and tackling that we always do in campaigns. People were very concerned about the integrity in government then because our last governor was also on his way to prison. So I'm not painting a great picture of the land of Lincoln here. But he ran as a reformer. And he also ran on a no-tax pledge at a time when the state was clearly in need of new revenues. And I thought that was disappointing. But it was the advice that you give, right? The polling says this would be a good position to take. He took it. And he was going to win. I mean, in the summer of 2002, it was clear he was going to win. The Republican candidate was a guy named Jim Ryan, who was a very, very good guy, conservative. I didn't agree with him on a lot of things, but I had a lot of integrity. But it was like watching Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd, you know. I mean, Rod was just running circles around him. And so I thought, it's time for me to do something else. And around that time is when Barack called. And he said, I'm thinking of running for the Senate, and I want to talk to you. And there were other people running for the Senate who had a much better chance, at least on paper. They had more money, better name recognition. But I told my wife, Susan, that, you know, this, if I could help Barack get elected to the Senate, this would really be, really recharge my idealism. It would be something I could be proud of for the rest of my life. So I threw in with him, and we went around with our tin cups trying to persuade people that he had a chance, because here was a black guy named Barack Hussein Obama, 1 year after a guy with a similar sounding name had visited havoc on the United States and in the World Trade Center. And, you know, it just seemed like a long shot. And so I had to basically persuade people in Chicago and Illinois, where I had some credibility, that this guy could win and how. And we started working together then, and that was the beginning of our relationship.
So you took him from, he was about 3% in the polls, to a 30-point lead win in the primary, and then a huge general election win. So let's fast forward from 2004.
Wait, before you fast forward, I'm enjoying reflecting on my life here. No, but there were, one thing I should say is that I learned a lot about him in that. That you and I both saw later. First of all, you know, I remember once getting a call from David Katz. You remember, who was his body man, young guy who was traveling with him from deep. They were down in right down by where Paul Simon's district was, and he was visiting a VFW hall and some other events. Katz said, "Gee, he's getting a great response down here," and I was like surprised by that. You know, and I told Barack that when he called me that night, and he said, "Why are you so surprised?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, black guy named Barack Hussein Obama, deep southern Illinois. I thought it could be challenging, you know." And he said, "You don't get it. They're just, these people are just like my grandparents from Kansas. You know, we talk about my grandfather who was in Patton's army and my grandmother who was Rosie the Riveter." And I realized that this guy was comfortable in any room he walked into, whether it was in southern Illinois in a VFW hall or a black church in the inner city of Chicago or in the Tony suburban parlor. He took people as they came. The second experience I had early with him was one that became sort of a historic event that I had no idea would be a historic event. Betty Lou, the same Betty Lou, called and asked him to appear at an anti-war rally in October of 2002, because the Senate was going to vote on this resolution to allow to authorize the president to go into Iraq. And almost every other candidate, major candidate, supported it, Republican and Democrat, because it was popular at the time. And Obama said, "What do you guys think?" And there was a discussion about the politics of whether he should go. And he said, "You know what, I'm against this war. I think it's a bad move. And so I'm going to go, and I'm going to speak." And he wrote a speech that night, and it was of such little consequence, the event, that, I mean, I didn't even see what he wrote before he went. My wife was at the rally and came back and said, "Gee, Barack made a great speech." And it turned out, as, and you know, because we've both read it since, it was probably the most prescient critique of why we shouldn't go into Iraq that anybody made anywhere. This guy who was a state senator from Illinois, you know, he talked about entering into a war of undetermined cost, undetermined length, and undetermined consequences. He talked about releasing sectarian strife in that area that we wouldn't be able to control, and becoming, making America the fulcrum for extremists, all of which came true. But, you know, so that was a kind of a revelation. And the third one was the Democratic convention in 2004. David Plouffe is an unsung hero in the story of Barack Obama's speech, because he was in Washington. We were then partners. And he was in Washington, and he was working his connections within the John Kerry campaign to try and get Barack this opportunity to speak at the convention. And he called me. We were down in a car in southern Illinois, and David called and said, "Mary Beth Cahill, Kerry's manager, is going to call in a few minutes and is going to offer Barack this spot." And he did, and she did, I should say. And he got off the phone and he said, "I know what I want to say. I want to talk about my story as part of the larger American story." And for the next few weeks, as he drove around the state and as he worked in the state Senate, he'd go into the men's room, you know, he was scribbling stuff there. And, you know, he put all these pieces of paper together and he pulled this draft together, sent it to me. I was on vacation and with Susan, and I'm like handing her one page. And by the third page, I thought, this is going to be like one of the great convention speeches of all time. I mean, it was so impressive. And then, you know, it was. And, you know, I stood on the floor of that convention hall with Robert Gibbs, our press secretary, and I said to him, his life is going to change forever, just change forever, right now. And our lives may have changed forever, too. I'd seen Mario Cuomo here in San Francisco in 1984 give his famous speech, and I saw what happened to him, and I felt the same thing was going to happen. And here's the last story, David, I promise, about the 2004 campaign. The first ad I ever did for Barack Obama was a biographical ad in which we talked about the improbable odds that he had overcome in various ways in his life. And it finished with him saying, and now they say we can't change Washington. So I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message to say, yes, we can. And I love the line, yes, we can, because it was inclusive. It wasn't just about him. It was about us. It was about everyone. It was positive. It optimistic. And he got to the end of the first read of the script, and he said, yes, we can. Yes, we can. Is that too corny? And I'm like, my heart stopped, because I really loved it. And I made the argument for it. And he was sort of like shaking his head, I don't know. And Michelle was there. She came to see him do his first ad, and she was sitting on the steps in this home in which we were shooting. She had her hand on her chin on her hands. And he said, Mish, what do you think? And she just kind of slowly shook her head, and she said, not corny. So thank God that she was there. That became a pretty important line.
This is a recurring theme. He's never liked a slogan or a logo we put in.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he didn't like our logo either. So anyway.
In part because of the reaction, the powerful reaction to the convention speech and then to his book, The Audacity of Hope, improbably 2 years after his election to the Senate, he starts convening meetings about whether he should run for president.
Right.
So in your book, you talk about a memo you write, and you actually have excerpts of it, a very honest and searing memo to the then-Senator Obama about whether you had questions about his ability to get in this arena and, as you put it, to take a punch. Talk a little bit about some of your reservations.
Well, I had seen him in the 2004 campaign. You know, it's great to be good and it's good to be lucky, and he was both, because one of his principal opponents in the primary ran into problems related to his marriage and divorce. And then the same thing happened in the general election. And so the Republican Party had no candidate, and they, in their infinite wisdom, they said, well, they've got this charismatic black man, so let's go get one too. And they went to Maryland and found Alan Keyes. And so Alan Keyes parachutes into Illinois and becomes the nominee for the Senate. And, it was clear. I mean, we were like 50 points ahead. But he got under Obama's skin like nobody's business. He knew exactly which buttons to push. You know, he challenged his racial identity, which was something, of course, that he had written a whole book about and was a source of great reflection on his part. He challenged his faith. He talked about his pro-choice position as having the slaveholder's position on abortion, and he was just as provocative as could be, and he just got under Obama's skin to the point where they were at a parade one day, and I'm watching the news. I wasn't there. I'm watching the news, and Obama goes up, and they almost get into a fist fight. And he's like, Keyes said, "Well, I'm looking forward to debating," and Obama's like pointing his finger, and Keyes, oh, we're going to debate. You've been talking. You've been doing a lot of talking. And I call him up that night, and I said, well, look, what are you doing? We're 50 points ahead. He said, that guy just gets on my nerves. So I'm thinking, there's a lot of provocation in a presidential race. And I was concerned about how he would take the constant kind of poking and prodding that would come. As I wrote in the memo, I said, I don't know if you're, and I don't know if you guys are any boxing enthusiasts here, but I said, I don't know if you're Muhammad Ali or Floyd Patterson. Floyd Patterson had a famously glass jaw, so when he got hit, he fell down. But I would had other concerns about running for president. And we should point out that I honestly did not believe in 2005 and for much of 2006 that he was going to run for president. You know, it just seems so improbable that he could do that. And but we slowly started, you know, things started happening that suggested, well, maybe he actually could. And we started doing things that candidly put logs on the fire. And by the fall of 2006, you know, he kind of commissioned us. And that's when you really deeply became involved with him to start looking at a presidential race. By the way, one thing, I got to tell one story about David Plouffe. Because this and it says everything about him. We were having these meetings about whether he should run or not. And, you know, one of his big concerns was his family, and that was Michelle's primary concern. How would this affect the family? And there was one guy, there was a small group of people involved in this, and there was Steve Hildebrand, was a great guy, you know, a true believer, and he really wanted Barack to run. And Michelle was asking, well, what is it like for the family? And Hildebrand proceeds to describe what sounds like a trip to Disneyland. I mean, said, it's great, you know, you get to see the country, and the kids can come along, and, you know, county fairs, they'll have such fun.
Weekends
and,
off.
Yeah. And then, so we're like stunned by this depiction. Because all of us have been veterans of presidential campaigns, and Plouffe, it comes around to Plouffe, and Plouffe says, look, let's be candid about this. It's going to be a miserable, horrible slog. And he starts describing what it was really like. But, you know, I think maybe in that moment, even before he revealed all his gifts, his visionary gifts for understanding what the campaigns of the future would be and everything that made him, I think, the greatest campaign manager in my lifetime. He established a bond with the Obamas because clearly here was a guy who was willing to tell the truth. And so that was, you know, that was a memorable moment from that journey. But I wasn't just worried about him being able to take a punch. I also was worried, and I told him this, I told him, I don't think you're pathological enough to run for president. Right. I'd worked for many of the other people who were running in various forms of and fashions, different campaigns and so on. And I said, these people are going to drag their asses out of bed at 4 in the morning every day because they have to be president. And I don't sense that you have to be president. And he acknowledged that. And he said, no, you know, he said, as it turns out, being Barack Obama, it's in and of itself is a pretty good gig. And he said, and I like being with my family. I like being with my friends. I like watching ESPN. He's like an extraordinary, ordinary guy. And he said, but if you're going to do public service, then, you know, you should want to do it at the place where you can have the most impact. And this is it. And he said, so if I run, you know, I assure you, I'm a competitive person. And he is. Anybody who's played basketball with him or done or anything, horse, you know, the guy will cut your throat to win a game of horse. He said, I will do what's necessary. But I did have concerns. And you know, because you're a veteran of the same process, you never know how someone's going to handle this process. You can, you know, it's like the astronaut program. They can be in the simulator all they want, but until they're in orbit, they don't really, you know, and you don't know how someone's going to handle the incredible pressure. Running for president is, in many ways, a ludicrous thing. I mean, the things that you get tested, the ways you get tested are some often unpredictable and almost always, like, absurd. But the pressures are unbelievable. And they should be because you're auditioning for the hardest job on the planet.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features political consultant and campaign strategist David Axelrod, whose new memoir is Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. He's joined in conversation by David Plouffe. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So 2007 was an epic year, and it's tragic, but I think we're going to have to... And it was filled with, by the way, one of the amazing things for me was watching David and Barack Obama, kind of two artists at the height of their craft, work together on crafting speeches and messaging. It was a sight to behold. But in the interest of time, I want to skip forward all the way through all the county fairs and relaxing weekends off.
Thank you, good
night. Let's talk about 2008, kind of that five-day period between... Yeah. The heights of winning the Iowa caucuses and the lows of losing the New Hampshire primary.
Yeah. Well, you know, 2007, you know, was...
he can't help himself.
No. I'm going to just do this briefly. Lots of highs and lows in that year. And, we started on a high. Yeah, but for much of the year, you know, David's feeling... And he was right, was that we had only one way to win the race, which was to win the Iowa caucuses. And so we were going to devote... Barack Obama spent 89 days in Iowa in 2007, probably qualified to participate in the caucuses by the time the thing was done. And the folks in Washington were derisive. We're not running a national campaign. You know, I know there's some donors and supporters in this room. I exempt you from this characterization. But it's fair to say that many of our donors were very generous with their advice during this period. And Obama himself had a rough, you know, the initiation. It took him like 6 months to really be comfortable as a candidate. So we really gained momentum at the end of the year, JJ dinner and so on. And then there was this magical night in Iowa. My son Ethan is here somewhere, and he and my wife were working for the week before the caucuses and phoning and everything. Right up until the end, I couldn't get them to come over to the victory night celebration because they wanted to make their last calls. But as you remember, it was just an awesome experience to win that night. I mean, it was there was a certain beautiful innocence to it. You know, we were like those. It was like Mr. Smith goes to Washington. You know, it really was. It was like a Frank Capra movie. But we just assumed that if we win the Iowa caucuses, that the New Hampshire primary was 5 days later, and we'd win that too. And we arrived in New Hampshire like a conquering army. You know. And we campaigned way up here, you know, big crowds, and, you know, we basically took victory laps for 5 days. And I remember you and I had this discussion. We had been in enough campaigns together and separately, and we both had pretty good guts on this. It just never felt right. It just felt like we hadn't earned it. We weren't close to the ground like we were in Iowa. And meanwhile, Hillary Clinton, who had campaigned way up here for a year, now... was really scuffling to, and she was down here campaigning with people, connecting with people, being more revealing of herself. We had that terrible debate that Saturday night where Obama uncharacteristically kind of tossed off this "you're likable enough, Hillary" line, which just made us all cringe. Our polling was, you know, we were still, the last poll I think was on Sunday, you know, 8 points. At one point it was 11 points. It's like, well, that's a big cushion. We ought to be able to win. And then you remember that night in New Hampshire when the results started coming in. Our state coordinator, poor guy, is looking at the first Manchester precincts and all the color drained from his face. And it was clear that we were going to have a We were going to not make it. We were going to lose. And then you and Gibbs and I went up to give the candidate the news, and we knocked on his door. He was in there with Michelle. I don't think any of us wanted to be there and tell her. So
I was glad he opened the door.
Yeah, we asked him to come out into the hall. And I think he suspected this was not good news. And I think you said, well, we're going to come up a little short, maybe 2 points short. And he said, well, what happened? And we talked a little bit about that. And he leaned against the wall, and he smiled kind of wanly, and he said, it's going to go on for a while, isn't it? And the next day, we were driving to Boston for what was supposed to be a victory celebration, right? We had a fundraiser. It was going to be rah, rah, rah. We sealed the nomination, you know, on to the general election and everything. And people were kind of shell-shocked. And he had about 3 hours sleep or something, and he stood up in front of this crowd and made a completely extemporaneous speech. And he said, I know a lot of you are disappointed. I understand that. And he said, but we were a little like Icarus flying too close to the sun. He said, you know, change isn't like this. Change doesn't happen without a fight. You have to struggle and work for it day in and day out. You know, this would have been too easy. And I think the people of New Hampshire were saying, you got to earn this. You got to earn this. So my message today is we got to get back to work. And we got to get down there and make our case to people and not assume too much. And I mean, he said, let me tell you why it's important. And then he gave this very inspiring speech about what was at stake. And that was one of those moments when I got great insight into him. Because, you know, you don't measure people when they're up. You measure them when they're down. And how do they handle adversity? And I think, you know, at every juncture when we were knocked on our butts, he was the guy who picked us up. You know, when we lost the Ohio and Texas primaries, and we invested so much in that, you, skinflint as you, though you were, allowed us to spend a lot of money trying to finish Hillary Clinton off in Texas and Ohio.
And that's where we looked at it. This would be it.
Right. And we ran uncharacteristically. We ran a much more political, sort of classically political campaign, you know, the kind of snarky male pieces and this and that. And it just, again, didn't feel right. And we ended up losing both. And on the plane back from Texas, Obama said, I want to see everybody in the office tomorrow afternoon. And like, we didn't know what to expect. And he came in with the familiar yellow legal pad. To this day, when I see a yellow legal pad, my blood runs cold because, you know, whenever things went wrong, he would come in with his yellow legal pad with his very meticulous handwriting, pages of questions, right? And he came in and he sat down. All of the senior staff was there. And he said, you know, I can think of a dozen things I could have done better in the last couple of weeks. And I know you can think of dozens of things you could have done better. So I'm not here to talk about who's to blame or, you know, that's not constructive. I want to figure out what we can do better so that we don't run into these problems. Again, we had this really constructive two-hour conversation. When he got up to leave, he was walking toward the door and he turned around and said, now, what do you understand? I'm not yelling at you guys. And then he turned around, took another couple of steps, and he turned around again and said, you know, but after, you know, spending $20 million, blowing $22 million, $20 million in 2 weeks, he said, I could yell at you. He said, but I'm not yelling at you. And he walked out the door. And I think, you know, everybody would have run through a wall for the guy at that moment. So, and then the other big test we came, that you and I were deeply
involved in, was
Reverend Wright. Reverend Wright. So
let's speak a little bit about, as I recall it, the president, or then Senator Obama, went out, I think it was on a Friday night, to a series of interviews to try and staunch the bleeding. Highly unsuccessful. And so that night he talked to both of us, but he had a long conversation with you about his views about what was going to be required to handle that. So
yeah. Well, first of all, the story broke on a Thursday. Right. So, you know, he was in the Senate, remember, for like a Votorama. So he was there until 1 or 2 in the mornings. He really was sort of insulated from the story, but it was like roaring out there. And, you know, nothing titillates the press more than stories about race. And particularly because they all were skeptical as to whether a black man could get elected president. So now, you know, now we were going to find out, you know, whether that was true. And so when he went on cable TV on Friday, when he got back to Chicago, he got a feel for just how virulent the thing was. And he said, I want to make a speech about Reverend Wright and race in politics, and I want to put this all in a context, and I want to do it no later than Tuesday. This was Friday night. And he said, and I have to write this speech. And I'm thinking he scheduled a campaign in Indiana on Saturday. We had a film shoot we had to do on Sunday. We had an all-day campaigning in Pennsylvania where we were involved in the Pennsylvania primary on Monday, and I'm thinking, when are you going to write this speech? He said, don't worry, just set it up. I know what I want to say. And so we set it up for Tuesday morning at the Constitution Center in Philadelphia on the theory that if you're going to go down on a big stage.
Right.
As you remember, Saturday night he dictated an outline to Jon Favreau, our great speechwriter. Jon tried to flesh it out a little. Sunday night, after the kids went to bed, he started working on this at like 10 at night, worked until 2 or 3 in the morning, and we left at 8 in the morning for Pennsylvania, and the speech was half done. And we got to Philly at the end of this long day of campaigning, and like 12 hours before the speech, and he said, he went to his room to work on the speech, and I went to the bar to drink because I didn't know what else to do. And the bar was filled, by the way, with reporters who had descended on Philadelphia like locusts, you know, who because they thought that they smelled blood here. And I may be mixing metaphors, I woke up at, you know, in the middle of the night, and I turned on my BlackBerry, and there was the speech, and you sent the speech, and I scrolled through the speech in the dark, and I finished it, and I emailed him back, and I said, this is why you should be president, because it was such an extraordinary and honest and personal and powerful statement written under the most extraordinary pressure. And the next day we got to Constitution Center. I was in the green room with him, and I said, I was tense, and his supporters were tense, and everybody was wondering how this was going to come off. This is going to be a nationally broadcast speech, and he said, I'm going to give this speech, and the worst thing that happens is people won't accept what I have to say, and I won't be president. He said, but at least I'll have said what I felt needed to be said, and he said, that's worth something. He said, so let's just go out and do it. And, it turned out to be a seminal moment because of the way he handled it and the presidential way in which he presented his ideas. And the Constitution Center was the right place for it. You know, it was such an appropriate place for it. But you learn about people in these processes. And we learned a lot. You and I learned a lot about him. All of it made us more enthusiastic than we were to begin with, and we were plenty enthusiastic to start with.
Right. But I want to skip forward. So obviously the long, epic primary with Hillary Clinton ends. We finally prevail. We win the general election. I thought it'd be interesting to speak to. So you have the headiness of that, your friend,
yeah,
the person we've spent hours beside on this journey every day becoming president. But then you have a meeting, I believe it's the next day, with the economic team.
Yeah.
Where the reality of what
basically
the president just earned was...
It wasn't quite the next day. It was a few weeks later, but it was...
Right.
It was the first time we had met with our economic team. And Christy Romer, who is from here, was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors incoming. She was an expert on the Great Depression, and she had all these charts to suggest that... this was going to be the deepest. She said, Mr. President, it's the first time, by the way, I heard everybody refer to him that way. Mr. President, this is going to be the deepest recession since the Great Depression. Larry Summers spoke and said, you know, this is going to put a hole in our output, and it's going to cost millions and millions of jobs. Geithner, the incoming Treasury Secretary, spoke and said the credit system is locked up, no loans are being given, and it could collapse. And then to cheer everybody up, Peter Orszag, the incoming budget director, said, oh, by the way, this is going to add trillions of dollars to the debt, and deficits are going to explode. And so Obama said, well, I guess it's too late to ask for a recount. and that room, what ensued was a discussion about the Recovery Act. But it was just so sobering to recognize what we were sailing into. And one other sobering thing that I should talk about, because it wasn't just about the economy. The night before the inauguration, I got a call from Rahm Emanuel, who was the incoming chief of staff, and he said, I call me on a hard line, and I did, and he said, we've been meeting with Chertoff, the Homeland Security Director from Bush all day, and there's a bona fide concern about a terrorist attack on Washington on the inauguration. And the president-elect may have to disperse the crowd if there's a feeling that something is up. And we need you to write I can't talk to the speechwriters about it, so you need to write a 60-second speech asking people to disperse peacefully. And, I wrote this, and he said, you can't talk to anybody, not your wife, not your... My son Ethan, who's here, was staying with me, and my wife Susan, and they were going the next day to church with the Obamas and the Bushes, the traditional service before the inauguration. And as they were leaving, I stayed up all night listening to sirens, wondering what was going on. And as they were leaving, I so wanted to tell them not to go because I didn't know what was going to happen. And, happily, it all worked out. But, these things were, we think we're involved in really important stuff in campaigns, and we are. But there's a whole nother level of, you're in an order of magnitude when you realize the sobriety of the things that you're going to have to deal with on a daily basis when you get to the White House.
I'm sure your conversation with Rahm was that polite and
yeah, yeah. Well, I have to say that the most colorful conversation I had with him was when I called him to tell him that late in the campaign that Obama was going to call him and ask him to be the chief of staff because he was on this very good scheme in the House. He was the fourth ranking member of the House. He had helped lead them to the majority. Everybody thought he might be Speaker of the House, and he was pretty happy, And he had been in the White House for 7 years under Clinton. He knew what the chief of staff's job involved, and he knew what the chief of staff's going to. And he said, "Don't." And I'll alter it a little. But he said, "Don't you tell him not to freaking call me. I don't want it." And he said, "I don't want that." But you know what I realized was, he knew that Rahm is a public-spirited guy. He knew that if the president of the United States incoming called him and said, I need you to be my chief of staff, that he couldn't, in good conscience, refuse it. So he didn't want the call. So so I went back to Obama and said, I think he'll do it. Give him a call.
David Axelrod, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was political consultant and campaign strategist David Axelrod, whose new memoir is Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. He was joined in conversation by David Plouffe. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espolay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature writer Andrew Solomon. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.